But they're right in all the important ways.
All right, the House Committee on Education will come to order. It is May 21st, 2012. Welcome. For those in the audience, if you would please take your cell phone, BlackBerry or whatever, and turn it all the way off. We do have people listening. I know for a fact today that we have people listening around the open enrollment piece, and the wireless signals interfere with their ability to hear on the internet. So please turn them all the way to off and not just to vibrate. We have a good agenda today, and we're going to get rolling. I will open an informational hearing on the Oregon Education Investment Board and invite Tim Nesbitt and Ben Cannon to come up and tell us how things are unfolding. Welcome.
Thank you.
And you are now officially allowed to talk to us anytime you want. Is that correct,
Representative? Yes, Madam Chair. For the record, Ben Cannon with the Governor's Office, frustrated with my inability to ever serve on this committee, I left the legislature so I could go sit on this side and talk to you in this capacity. Glad to be back.
And Madam Chair, I'm Tim Nesbitt, manager of the Governor's Oregon Education Investment Project and staff to the Oregon Education Investment Board. I think I'm going to lead off since we have on the agenda first achievement compacts and the process for filling the chief education officer position. So I'll address those two, and I think you should have handouts in front of you that I provided. To bring you up to date on achievement compacts, which you launched with your passage of Senate Bill, should be SB 1581 there on your handout, last February, and the signing into law of that legislation on March 6th, you see that we recapped here the purposes we talked about with you as that legislation was developed and advanced, and certainly creating a common focus among all of our education entities on key outcomes, establishing a baseline of outcomes in the coming school year, 12-13, leading to a process where districts will be budgeting a plan, not just planning a budget. And also, as you'll hear more from Ben, the importance of being in alignment with the requirements of the No Child Left Behind waiver, these achievement compacts, and the targets that they require will, in fact, meet the goal of having annual measurable objectives in our waiver from the No Child Left Behind Act. They'll also help to give us the information we'll need to understand the distance we have to travel to achieve our 40-40-20 goals and how we might establish and construct a trajectory to get there by that year 2025. And finally, they are instruments for informing at both the local and the state level our investment decisions. So following your passage of the law, the board, having convened an advisory committee, adopted temporary rules, which provided more definition for the districts and other institutions to respond to the achievement compacts. And as part of that, determine what the measures are, and you see them in the attachments here, and also determine that although not required by the legislation, we eventually arrived at the importance of having targets set, not just results reported, but targets set for all the various groups of students, sometimes referred to as subgroups, both disadvantaged groups and those who are in the category of TAG students. So that was done by board action and reflected in the rules. And on April 12th, on April 5th, we started the distribution of those compacts first to the all 197 K-12 districts and 19 ESDs, and then a week later to the community colleges, OUS, and the 7 universities, and to OHSU. We've been spending a lot of time on the phone and in webinars and informal and formal sessions with superintendents and other representatives of our K-12 districts and community colleges and others to work with them on completing the compacts. And we had a presentation at our last board meeting on how we might start constructing that trajectory to our 40-40-20 goals over the next 13 years. And the findings there, just to recap briefly, are that if we look at the performance from the data we have over the last 7 years, we project forward and we take into account the changing demographics of our student populations, which will become more challenging as we foresee more English language learners, more students in poverty coming into the system. We do see improvement, although it's modest. A couple of points on the test scores, the OAKS scores, and a couple of points on high school completion. But we also see a plateauing in the latter part of the coming of this decade, with high school completion at about 70%, and the OAKS scores having bumped up a couple of points. And we think that is largely a reflection of the increased challenges we'll be facing with the changing demographics of our student population, but it also lays out for us the ground we have to cover, the distance we have to make up in aligning those challenges with the goals we have for our 40-40-20 overall goal. And that'll be work going forward. That's going to be a big part of what we learned from the first year's achievement compacts and what we helped to develop working with the board going forward. We're going to have a similar presentation from work being done by the National Commission on Higher Education Management Systems, with whom we've contracted to help identify that post-secondary gap, the first and second 40 in the 40-40-20 scheme. And we'll be getting the results of their work, at least a first look at it, at the next board meeting in June. We'll be getting our achievement compacts back from the districts by July 2nd. We will also at that point be finalizing what the kindergarten readiness assessment, the criteria that will go into that assessment, will look like by mid-July. That's something that the Early Learning Council will do. And by the end of July, we'll have the Chief Education Officer responding to what's been submitted in the compacts, including the optional provisions that many districts will be choosing to give us, called local priorities. If I can turn your attention to the second handout here, which is a display of how these our measures of progress and completion and connections in the compacts align across the P20 continuum, because this is a major part of the work of the Oregon Education Investment Board, which is to develop that unified educational continuum from early childhood through college and career readiness. And you see here that we have, especially in the middle column, flagged as high school and college connections, a lot of common measures. It's this schematic here. A lot of common measures where the same measures appear in the K-12 compacts as appear in the community college and OUS compacts. And that's led to a lot of discussion and very productive dialogue between our community colleges and universities and our K-12 districts. I can summarize for you as you look at this array. You see some of these measures not yet ready, a couple of asterisks or three asterisks on the kindergarten readiness assessment. There's more detail in your packet about that, how that's being developed. The third grade reading and third grade math and the sixth grade attendance are based on data already collected and already in the system. So those are not new, but they're new in the sense that districts will be focused on setting targets for those measures of progress. The ninth grade on track is actually a measure which consists of both attendance and completing six credits in the freshman year of high school. The latter piece, completion of six credits, is new. The attendance data is not. The attendance data was already part of what was collected and reported by the districts. The focus and priority schools are a definition which flows from currently the No Child Left Behind Act definitions, but will also be modified to reflect what the waiver puts forward in the coming school year. So that is a measure which will be modified as we go forward. Four-year and five-year graduation rate also took some clarity because not all districts were used to reporting in the same way. So we have flagged that as a modified measure where they're all working to make sure they're reporting and using the same terms of the definitions there, as well as the five-year completion rate. The earning of 9-plus college credits in high school is a new measure, as is post-secondary enrollment within 16 months. We're seeing a lot of good discussion and early reports on the use of that measure of earning college credits in high school. I don't know if you noticed the story that ran in the Oregonian after we provided the National Student Clearinghouse data, which showed how different districts were doing in their college-going rate and also mentioned those which were successful in providing college credit courses to their high school students. And one quote that sticks in my mind from a David Douglas senior was he found in his senior year that he had 8 college credits on his transcript, and he told the reporter that he hadn't planned to go to college, but now he was going because he didn't want to waste them. And this is an area where we think there will be a lot of productivity and a lot of productive discussions in terms of bringing more college credit coursework into the high schools and seeing the results in student success and a college-going rate, college-going culture developed thereby. When that story ran, by the way, we had the data from the 09-10 school year. We've since gotten the data from the 2010-11 school year, and we've provided that to the districts as well. Also, in the community college compacts, measures like dual enrollment in high school and passing national licensure exams and the certificates in Oregon transfer models and associate degrees, dual enrollment in OUS and transfers to OUS, they were all part of the KPMs, which had been used. Now they'll be reflected with a little more sense of importance in the compacts. The programs of study is something that the community college representatives are still working on, as are measures of employment post-college. And then finally, in OUS, a lot of these same measures had been reported to the joint boards or included in the OUS fact book. Measures like freshmen entering with high school dual credit, degrees for Oregonians, and degrees granted to community college transfer students and advanced degrees. But now these will be, again, given extra priority and focus in the compacts. You'll see that as well. The compacts provide for what are called local priorities. In other words, districts can indicate there are additional measures they would like to use. They would like to inform their compact with the state, with the OEIB, and we expect to learn from them, as we will learn from the districts completing these compacts, engaging with us on how they find the data and use the data effectively to set targets. And we expect when we see the results coming in that we'll learn as well from areas where districts choose to put extra effort. Where do they put the rigor? And we've advised districts that all of these are required, but we've also advised them that in the exercise of completing their compacts, they may want to put extra focus on some measures and tell us why they're doing that. And we'll learn from that as well. I would say that in terms of what we've already learned, the legislation requires that districts set targets for the coming school year. It does not require something which we put on the compacts as optional, that they do so for 4 years out. And we think that could, in fact, be a lot more informative and a lot more useful to do. And so we may be coming back to you next session saying perhaps a longer-term look should be something that's required. Perhaps we'll find a lot of cooperation in that effort in the future with the districts, and we'll need to do that. But there's only so much that can be done in the final year of a 12-year educational experience in K-12. There's a lot more that can be done for high school freshmen or your third graders. And so taking that long-term look, which you see reflected in those measures there for the ninth graders of 2009-10, for the ninth graders of 08-09, et cetera, there'll be a lot to be learned there as districts begin to set targets on a longer-term basis. We also want to continue to examine the potential for compacts at the local level, the community level, engaging more than just the state and districts, but providers of services, community groups, and other stakeholders as we talk about how we can bring the culture of a compact to the community level and talk about community compacts that might include the provision of wraparound services and other community engagement, which we think will be certainly critical to achieving our goals as well. So that's a first look at how we've been implementing the compacts, what we hope to learn from them. You see more material here. You see the sample compact, actually, for all of the districts and the colleges and universities, the university system. And then finally, a summary of where we are in adopting a kindergarten readiness assessment, which will be piloted in 15 schools in the 12-13 school year and ready to roll forward statewide in the 13-14 school year. With that, I'll stop, and before moving on to Chief Education Officer, I'll ask Ben if he has anything to add, and then answer any questions you may have, and then I'll give you the report on the Chief Education Officer process.
Nothing to add. Are there questions from the panel? Representative Frederick?
A couple questions. One is, you continue the sixth grade attendance piece within the progress. I'm curious about why there's no academic component within that. You do have the credits for the ninth grade. You have math and reading for third grade. But attendance is the only thing that you're looking at regarding sixth grade. Can you give me a reason for that, or give me what the explanation has been so far for that?
Sounds like Ben wants to answer first, and he's been...
I'll jump in here. Thank you, Representative Frederick, Madam Chair. So these, each and every one of these measures was there were pushed and pulled over. We were responding to literature in the case of this measure and most of them that indicated that sixth grade attendance was a powerful predictor of a student's academic success. Obviously, it indicates whether they're showing up for school, but it actually helps predict their longer term academic success. One of the challenges around any directly academic indicator is how to get that on a statewide basis without defaulting in every case merely to the standardized tests, the reading and math OAKS, which we've done in the case of third grade. We know that's a powerful, itself a powerful predictor of success. We were attempting not to default there too very often. So the sixth grade measure is attendance alone, but we've got some good research that we'd be happy to point you toward that has shown that year in particular, for many students, a transition year does predict future success, academic as well as staying in school.
Representative, do you have a follow-up?
And I have a follow-up, but it's not on that particular issue, so
we'll come back. Is that okay?
That's right.
Representative Winger?
Thank you. Gentlemen, a couple of questions for you. One is, from looking at the materials, is it still your intention to sign an achievement compact with the entire OUS system and the entire community college system, or are you going to break that out to achievement compacts with each community college and with each university within the OUS system?
Mr. Co-Chair, it's both. We'll have a compact with the university system, and in addition, there will be compacts between the OEIB and each of the seven universities.
What is the purpose of having both?
First of all, it's required in the legislation. And secondly, the purpose is that, and we're going to leave this to each university to tell us in the first year under local priorities, what specific to its own mission it would like to set targets for and report on. The first iteration of compacts we received from OUS had a number of university-specific measures. We decided, in the interest of not having these lists too long, you'll see right now that I think the maximum number is 10 in any compact. We would, in the first year, let each of the universities tell us what specific university-specific measures they want to track. So we'll get those, and we'll make an assessment next year how to differentiate among the within the portfolio of common OUS mission, the more university-specific missions.
So my last question, I appreciate that you've fought very hard to keep the list thin of the number of things you're going to try to hold them to and keep them broad enough that they can work out their own kind of internal changes they need to reach those larger goals. I really think that is the way to go at something like this. The only thing that I really see missing from the list is at the top end, you know, when they're coming out of the community college or the higher education system, holding that system accountable for the debt to income ratio that they are leaving their alumni with. You know, whether it's a history degree or a pre-law degree or a medical degree, we know what the basic salaries are likely to be for those professions, and yet they're often coming out with the same debt loads. And it may work for some, it may seem really ludicrous for others. And until we hold them accountable for the debt to income ratio that the student is leaving with, I don't think they'll start to ask those internal questions about, do you really want to rack up $40,000 in debt or $80,000 in debt to get an English degree, you know, or whatever it may be. But somebody needs to be having those conversations, and I don't think unless we have something on here that holds them accountable for that, those conversations will occur. So I would encourage you to seriously think about that one on the higher.
Mr. Co-Chair, we did have that discussion and considered and then set aside, but it'll come back up again because we decided to take it up again for the next year.
Thank you.
Under the general heading of access and affordability, I don't think we got right in every instance to the course of the cost of a particular course of study versus the employment opportunity thereafter. And you'll see that the university system will be doing an alumni satisfaction survey, which might capture some of that. as well as a post-college and community colleges as well, a post-college employment survey.
Well, just as a follow-up to that, though, I mean, what we see when we read stories time and time again about this is how surprised. I mean, the students don't really think about it until they're out, and then they have a six-month delay, and then the payments come, right? And it's only at that moment that they really get focused on what they just spent 4 years doing, what they're earning, and whether or not they're really able to pay this off. But the adults in the system, you know, have the ability to do a much longer view and should be having that conversation with them much, much earlier. And I can't encourage you enough that I think that needs to be a part of the accountability measures in the achievement compacts.
And if I could add, Mr. Co-Chair, you know, in the Oregon Opportunity Grant shared responsibility model, we took that on directly, and we have within that model a definition of affordability, tuition, fees, cost of attendance, student resources, family resources, federal aid, and what's left being the affordability gap. We assumed in building that model that there'd be no borrowing at the community college level, something which maybe deserves further attention, but we also assumed at the university level that the borrowing would be no more than $3,000 a year so that students wouldn't be graduating more than $12,000 in debt. And that wasn't based on a number plucked from the sky. It was based on a National Student Association survey of what it would be feasible for a student to pay off after graduation if he or she went to a fairly low-paid occupation like social work requiring a four-year degree. It didn't go further to say that based on your course of study, maybe your ability to repay would be greater. So it took kind of the least common denominator. But there has been attention paid to that very issue, and we do have standards of affordability and what is affordable in terms of debt on the record in our Oregon Opportunity Grant Share Responsibility Model.
Thank you.
Well, and because we're on the college and university portion, I wanted to interject a question. Did you have any discussion about any measure at the entry level of students coming in about the number of Oregon students they're enrolling? I know there may be one large university that is concerned about the relative burden that they will shoulder of educating Oregon students to hit 40-40-20 if another institution is primarily marketing to out-of-state students and increasing the difficulty for Oregon students to enter. And that is a concern that I'm hearing loudly from Oregon State University relative to the contribution of the University of Oregon. Is that being discussed in a transparent way at the OEIB? And will we be asking all universities to shoulder their share of the work and burden of educating Oregon students?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, very much so. And you'll see in the compact that we're asking not just for percentage, we're not asking for percentage of degrees awarded to Oregonians, we're asking for the absolute number. And those numbers then will be compared to where we think we need to be over the next 13 years to achieve our goals. So it's very much a matter of, again, not just the percentage of Oregonians you're enrolling, but also the number and how that equates to achieving our first or second 40 if you're a university or a community college.
And as part of that, will we be comparing the relative amount of Oregon resource and Oregon public investment in higher education that is going to educate Oregon students versus, say, California students between universities?
There is a measure of the dollar amount in invested in the coming year, just as there is for K-12 in the university compacts, and as well for the for the community college compact. So the dollar amounts are there. We haven't yet determined what combination of improvement in the delivery of education and investment in both capacity and the magnitude of investment needed over time. That's something that will be, well, as I mentioned, we're going to be getting a first report at our June meeting on what the gap looks like, and then we'll be going back to the findings of the Post-Secondary Quality Education Commission, which was co-chaired by President Ray from OSU, which made some calculations of how we closed that gap a couple years ago. So we'll be updating those as well.
Thank you. I just think it's important when we are looking at a systemic level for an individual university trying to survive with the inadequate resources. It may be a great strategy to pull students from another state and make up some of those revenues with out-of-state revenues. As a system, we need to recognize that Oregonians are making an investment in the education of these students from out-of-state who then leave and go someplace else and take that Oregon investment. So my hope is that we look at how do we preserve those resources and first spend Oregon higher education dollars on students that are homegrown here in Oregon. Representative Comp.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I have a couple of questions. Can I wander around on my questions, or do I need to stay focused?
Focused to the extent that you're able, but we'll be tolerant of you.
Okay. The first one I have for. How, particularly on the K-12 compacts, are we looking at our previous model for the quality education model? Are we taking components out of the QEM that were identified as best practices, and are some of those things part of the compacts?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Comp, that'll be part of the effort we apply to analyzing the targets that are set and the results we see achieved in the compacts. We are also working with the Quality Education Commission, something we were tasked to do in the legislation. And I attended their most recent meeting where they're talking about a process where they're going to identify what they call matched pairs of schools where the investment and the demographics of the student population look similar.
Right.
And they'll be going in and making on-site assessments and helping to learn from what appears to be working better in one school that can perhaps inform better student outcomes in another. That's a very similar process which we want to follow. So we're going to be working with them. This is the Quality Education Commission now, in taking advantage of their work and to inform our work when it comes to the analysis and dialogue that will occur between the board and chief education officer and his or her representatives with each district that we focus on.
Okay. And a follow-up on that question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me see. I had it structured in my brain so I could make it brief. But our... That one's gone, so it's a different. I'm going to go to a different question. When Representative Frederick asked about the lack of a different measure for sixth graders, are we following? How does the compacts align with our federal requirements for No Child Left Behind?
So, Representative Comp, Mr. Co-Chair. The ESEA flexibility waiver requires that the state establish a methodology for setting ambitious but achievable annual measurable objectives for all schools and all subgroups. We are using several kind of interlocking ways to do so. One of them is the Achievement Compact, which of course leans on districts, school districts, to set goals in targeted areas, not every grade, reading and math and graduation, but certain targeted measures for improvement, and then anticipates a dynamic process of the state working with districts and their communities to help improve performance to reach those targets, including intentional budget setting by the state and districts to support those efforts. And that is that's consistent, we believe, with the federal intent behind the requirement to set annual measurable objectives. And it's not the sole way in which objectives will be embedded within the accountability system. So I could go on to describe, and I'll have a short presentation when we get to it, our approach to the ESEA flexibility waiver, including other ways in which we're attempting to build a post-NCLB state-based accountability system for Oregon.
Okay. Follow up with No Child Left Behind. It may be different, but I thought that the No Child Left Behind required us to assess our students in 3, 5, 8, and 10.
So, Madam Chair, or Madam Representative Comp and yeah. Mr. Co-Chair, the federal requirements for annual summative testing are not modified under the ESCA flexibility waiver, so we will be required to continue to test annually in
every
reading
year.
And math in 3rd through 8th and 11th. So that requirement is the same.
And that's a bummer.
And those, the results of those tests will be used to inform the state's identification of focus priority and model schools.
Okay, that's disappointing, but I mean, seriously, I wish we could limit the amount of the summative assessments and allow teachers to teach. The last thing that I'm concerned about is something that came up in a committee meeting this morning when we had, when we allocated additional funds in, I don't know which session it was, but we asked the school districts to give us a brief report what those additional funds were spent on. To this date, after three notices to all the districts, we still have 11 school districts that have not complied with the budget note that we wrote to allocate those funds to keep their schools going for the end of that biennium. I'm real concerned about, well, the question is, if a school district doesn't complete their compact work, what are we going to need to do? Second of all, if they don't, is the data that's turned in on a regular basis going to suffice getting some of this information, even if the district doesn't send possibly complete their compact information? Sorry for the tough question.
Yeah, I'll take the latter portion of that, and you can talk about what happens if a district doesn't submit. But on the question of whether the data will be present anyway, yes, most of this achievement data is reported annually for schools and school districts anyway. Not all of it, but most of it. We've established a new measure for earning college credits, but the rest of it is reported regularly anyway. What's not reported, of course, are district-level goals, the targets that districts are choosing to put in their compact. So a district that failed to complete a compact would not be expressing to the OEIB and the state its goals for improvement.
Okay.
And Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Comp, we had that question from only one district so far, and made it clear that this body and the governor, in the passage and signing of the legislation, are requiring this, and failure to comply is not an option. If a district does not meet its deadline, the chief education officer has the authority to waive a timeline or adjust the timeline for a good reason to be determined by the chief education officer. And we will continue to work with every district to make sure that it is in compliance. If it takes a visit by the chief education officer to the school board, we'll arrange that.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, just one last point. Being a previous school administrator, when I look at this timeline, if I was a principal in a school today, and this is May, and I haven't spent a whole lot of time learning what the legislature passed in 2011 or 2012, and then I come to you know, June, July, and August, I'm thinking, what do I need to do to support my staff? And my staff doesn't have, and I don't know anything about achievement compacts. I mean, we're asking a tremendous amount from our schools. And I guess it's more of a comment than a question. And I'm putting myself in the school principal's shoes and saying, how am I going to bring my teachers up to speed, my counselors, my everybody that works to keep the school functioning, and that we have this big, I mean, we are now moving the Titanic in a dramatic shift. And I just know that we're all going to need a lot of professionalism and training and understanding as we go through this process, because it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough to have this level of change.
Thank you, Representative Representative Parrish.
Thanks. Well, I'm sorry we jumped back to K-12 because I wanted to actually talk about the college level and kind of go a little further with what Representative Winger was trying to ask, because I guess I have some frustration, not around the affordability piece. I mean, I think I'm probably one of the only people still writing a check for student loans sitting up here. So I appreciate affordability at some point.
My kids.
and having a college degree that's affordable. But one of the things in a conversation I had, actually in a Rotary group, what we were talking about was culpability, which is a little different than affordability. Where is our university system culpable for the output? And what by saying that, I guess I mean I took archaeology and anthropology classes, and those were great. Learned a lot, but that's not what I went to school for. And when we're cranking out kids with degrees like that, we only have one state archaeologist. Of course, they're not going to be able to come out and have a real world job. So, at what point is the university system, college system, community college system, culpable for the types of output that they are helping? You know, we give kids an education that they're actually going into a market based degree. Whether that's right now, we have very low unemployment for engineers. We need 58,000 healthcare workers. We probably don't necessarily need more more archaeology degrees and some of those other things. And I appreciate that those might have an impact on the people who teach those classes. And if we're pushing kids towards things that they can actually have transferable job skills when they graduate. Affordability is great, but right now I can afford my student loans because I have a degree that gave me job skills. So I think there's some measure of how do we put into the system and compacts that there is some accountability for outcomes, and that we're not, putting kids into degree programs just to keep college professors staffed, which, truthfully, when we're cranking out kids who don't have job-based degrees, that's a problem.
Well, I think we're going to, if we could get Representative Congress' question in, I think you've raised a series
of
interesting...
I'd like an answer for it.
Okay,
though.
An answer. We're busy, I just want to caution the committee. I think we could get into a very long discussion about this, and maybe it's a discussion we can have on another day rather than having the back and forth on the panel.
Sure.
So an answer here...
And Madam Chair, can I just say... We're actually having these guys, or at least Mr. Nesbitt, into the higher ed committee meeting on Wednesday, where we're going to be focusing on achievement compacts for higher ed.
Okay. And maybe some of this conversation. I didn't mean to cut off their response. I can see if people have thoughts. It would be a great conversation for us to have later, but probably not today to flesh this whole thing.
If I can give a brief answer, Madam Co-Chair and Representative Parrish, very much a topic of discussion ongoing at the board level. An early version of some of the university compacts had measurements for not just degrees, but degrees in the STEM series, science, technology, engineering, and math. And in the interest of keeping the list short in the first year, we decided not to do that. We may see some of those appear on the local priorities column of university compacts, but the board is very interested in continuing the discussion about how do we align the incentives that we want represented in the achievement compacts with the very thing you're talking about, the need for trained professionals in certain professions and fields of endeavor.
Thank you. Representative Conger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of my questions got stolen, which you'll be glad to hear. So they were actually, I want to start by saying I appreciate the amount of work and thought that's gone into this. I think the balance between becoming too detailed and keeping it simple enough that you can address some of the concerns for schools and school districts, the representative comp raised, is critical, because if we make the standard something, or if we make the amount of work to be done or to even understand what's going on, if that threshold is so high, then we shouldn't be surprised if no one succeeds in meeting the standards that we're trying to set. The other thing I want to echo is Representative Frederick's point about sixth grade attendance. I appreciated him raising that question. And I would just encourage you to consider whether, instead of measuring key indicators of academic success, it would be more appropriate to measure academic success. I don't think attendance is the right look at, and this is not, I'm not inviting an answer. You already answered his question, I thought, very well. but I want to comment that it seems to me that instead of looking at the input side of the equation, we should be looking at actual results and measuring performance. And that gets me to one more comment and then my question. The testing, I just want to pass along that a lot of teachers, actually some very, very good teachers, have invited me into their classroom. I've been very fortunate to be able to observe them teaching, and a universal concern that comes out of those meetings. You would think it's money or something like that. It's not. It's testing. And they, it's two things. It's class size and testing. And on the testing, I think hopefully we're all on the same page that we need testing that is meaningful, that provides meaningful feedback to the teachers so that they can teach better and address needs of the students. And I'm not sure that that's a topic to take up today, but I just want to encourage you to continue the good work and look for those opportunities too. My question is this. As I look at this, it seems like we sort of have arrayed in front of us some very good measurements of success. And I've always thought that this legislation had a lot of promise in two ways. One is better measuring success so that people actually know whether they're succeeding or not and perhaps can exchange ideas about what helps them succeed. But then the other is actually encouraging success. And in all of this conversation, we really haven't got to the point yet where we're talking about what happens if they just don't, if a school doesn't do it. Do we help? Do we hurt? And so my question is, you say that these measurements that I'm looking at this page, these measurements are reflected in achievement compacts. What does that mean?
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Conger, it means, first of all, that districts, by the end of June, will be setting targets for each of these measures, and in many cases for many of the groups of students within their student populations. They'll be informed by what they've done, in most cases, up to date, so they have some data we're providing to them of how their prior year...
Baseline to measure.
That's
from.
Right. And, okay. And from that... perhaps with more rigor applied to some of the target setting than others, we will get an array of targets for every district that is aligned, same measures, and will help inform us and inform them of how going forward we can best achieve those and best work to get a focus on those targets, as opposed to a diversity of targets or goals that may have been set by different districts around the state, or some not at all. We'll at least see all districts in the state taking a first step towards an outcomes focus when they adopt their budget, and most importantly, all focused on the same outcomes.
May I briefly follow up on that?
Very briefly.
It will be brief. That actually was about 80% of the answer that I was looking for, the baselines. But the other side of that, I guess, is and the transparency or the comparative data, I think, that's really encouraging. The part that I still maybe don't understand is, excuse me, when the schools or the districts are setting targets for themselves, they, and admittedly, they're coming from baseline data, but you could have an underperforming school that is underperforming for a reason that shows some good improvement, but really isn't even in the same range as a school that's actually performing well. And so some of this strikes me as there's two potential issues that need to be addressed as this evolves. One would be that comparative data needs to really, we need to figure out how to make it comparative. And mm-hmm. The other is that when we say compacts, it implies to me contracts or agreements. And with contracts or agreements, there are consequences for breaching it. And we don't have, so far as I can tell, and maybe we're just not to the point yet where we understand this, but we don't have either the carrot or the stick yet to try to encourage or encourage good behavior or punish bad behavior.
Thank you. And we are we're already about 22 minutes behind. I know that we need to move into a brief overview of the hiring for the Chief Investment Officer. I wanted to quickly highlight one other thing on the Achievement Compacts and just to thank the OEIB for adopting five-year completion goals that only include standards-based outcomes for students. And I'm hoping that that's getting communicated to school districts, that certificates of attendance and alternative certificates are not counted as successful outcomes for students in schools, and hopefully that will start changing the way that students and parents are advised as they're looking at whether to pursue a standard, modified, or extended diploma. Has that information been communicated clearly to districts that certificates of attendance and alternative certificates do not count as a successful five-year completion?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, a lot of discussion on that, because and Margie Lau, who's sitting here behind me, has been our point person and has been answering a lot of questions in this area. And so we're getting to a common understanding of that point with the districts.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that very much. I don't think any of us want to be investing in students for 21 years and having them just age out without any standards-based outcomes for them. So thank you so much. It's a great improvement to raise expectations for some of our kids that we're leaving behind the most. So the Chief Investment Officer.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, we provided for you a memo that updated the board at the last meeting on May 8th from the chair of our screening panel, Julia Brim Edwards, which summarizes the work done through the recruitment firm, Greenwood Asher, in terms of outreach, in terms of the type of candidates contacted, the recruitment status, and the process which has led through a third round of interviews with the governor, and a decision now pending by the end of this week, where the governor will determine one or more finalists to move forward to the investment board. And the investment board will meet on May 31st to interview those finalists. And we expect to make a decision on May 31st. And we expect to have a chief education officer on board by the end of June at the latest.
Thank you. Questions about this portion of the update?
I do have one, yes.
Yes, Representative Frederick.
Having dealt with four separate superintendent searches in the Portland schools, it's been an interesting experience. Are we not hearing who the names are because of a concern about their particular careers? Are we not hearing who the names might be because of the of a particular desire to be secret? I mean, I'm just trying to get an idea of what the transparency is, because quite frankly, there doesn't appear to be much.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Frederick, it's the former. This process is designed with confidentiality in mind, not for its own sake, but to make sure that we are engaging as many qualified candidates as possible, and we continue to check in with them about their willingness to have their names known. The latest question of that kind was, once the governor arrives at his final list, will you be willing to have your name made known then? And we don't have unanimity on that point from all the candidates, but we will, as soon as we can, make the names known. And that'll be sometime between the end of this week and the board meeting on May 31st.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you both very much for coming, and we'll see you again next time, I'm sure.
Madam Co-Chair, let me just flag a piece of information that I've left behind that describes the process for developing the governor's recommended budget. Ordinarily, I don't think we'd spend much or any time talking about the development of the GRB to a legislative committee, since you, of course, will write and adopt your own budgets. But the existence of the Oregon Education Investment Board as a public entity created in part by the legislature to develop a budget suggests a more public and robust process of developing an outcomes-oriented P20 budget. That work is beginning this month and next, and there's a sheet that describes some of the interaction between the program funding team that we've appointed for education to develop recommendations to the governor and the OEIB. So I'll be happy to explain at a later date sort of our work on that, answer questions at some future point in time. Was also prepared to discuss today, just flag it, our progress and process on the ESCA flexibility waiver. So if you have questions about how that's proceeding, be in touch. We think we're still on track and potential approval this month or the next.
And just a quick question that the budget issue raises for me. For the K-12 budget, generally in this building, what we have is a number that then runs through a funding formula that is exceedingly difficult to change and would require statutory change. So when you talk about setting this budget, are you looking at coming to the legislature with recommended changes to the funding formula, or does your work recognize that our K-12 budgets really are governed by a K-12 funding formula?
Two options here, and we haven't made any decisions. We could do either one of the two, both, or neither. They include, so option one would be to say we're going to attempt to change the K-12 funding formula because there's a better way to allocate the resources that we dedicate to K-12 between districts. That would be option one. Option two, not incompatible, would be more consistent with what this legislature has done historically, which is to say there are some dollars that will not be put through, will be spent on K-12, but not put through the funding formula, or even if they're allocated on largely the same basis, will have certain kinds of strings attached. And Representative Comp alluded to that grant funding that has been that was done in this biennium and in previous bienniums. I think that's sort of the realm of possibilities. Of course, our work is to develop a P20 budget and be thinking about the broader issues of early education through higher ed as we come up with that proposal for education.
Thank you very much.
Can I just ask one quick question about that? So, Ben, how are you planning to engage the legislature through this process? I mean, you don't want to have a situation where it goes through a whole set of decisions and process, and then it comes to us, and it falls flat as a pancake.
Yeah, Representative Denbrough, Madam Chair, it's a very important question, and we are developing a engagement and communications plan, not only with the legislature, but with other kind of stakeholders as this work proceeds. I mean, historically, the development of the governor's recommended budget has largely been a, you know, governor and executive branch-led process. That will continue to be the case in terms of leadership, but to the extent that we propose doing things very differently, we understand we will need to sort of tend to the ground in which those seeds will be received, and that will require significant outreach to you and your colleagues, as well as others, and there are many who have a very direct and strong interest in the proposals for an education budget.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
So with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing on the Oregon Education Investment Board Achievement Compacts and the recruitment process for the Chief Investment Officer, and open an informational update on the 10-year strategic plan from the Oregon Commission on Autism Spectrum Disorder. And I would invite Marilyn Gintz, Sue Gartland, and Marilyn Narcissum.
This is not the time of day to dim the lights.
I like it.
And I just want to check, because not on the invited testimony, but is there anyone in the room that would like to speak that experiences autism that wants to have?
I don't think so.
Okay. Thanks.
So, Representative Geltzer, thank you very much for this opportunity, and committee members. My name is Marilyn Gintz, and I'm the chair of the Governor's Commission on Autism. I want to say that we've had a number of our meetings in this building, and we actually sat up there. I kind of like sitting up there better than over here. It seems a little easier. I'll try to be brief and succinct and kind of tell you where we are. We had the Governor's Commission, and we developed a 10-year plan. And if you want a copy of the 10-year plan, we're happy to provide it to you. We have both electronically. We have paper copies, which are the recommendations for services across the age span. And then you have a very brief PowerPoint that you're looking at, I believe, that you have on your computers to look at today. And after the recommendations were put in place, then the governor reinstituted or continued the commission in order to work on the implementation phase. And that's what we're here to talk to you just very briefly about, and perhaps seek some guidance of where we go next on some of our issues. I also have with me, I apologize, this is Susan Gartland, and she is from Dallas School District, and Marilyn Narcissian from Eugene School District.
I wanted to say that the Department of Education, in their process of looking at new endeavors, particularly around special education, has talked about scaling up. And the commission, in the way that we've looked at our education issues and all of our issues, has really approached this scaling up process where we have a number of subcommittees. We have a 15 member commission, and then we have subcommittees, and each of those subcommittees has a broad representation: individuals with autism, local school districts, parents, direct service providers, so that every step of the way, in addition to using evidence-based practices that are available nationwide, we've also used the array of individuals who are impacted in some way by autism in order to build a clear picture. And we have a website if you would like more information. We try to keep that up to date. What I wanted to tell you about is four areas that we're addressing, and these are just from recommendations to implementation in the broader education arena. So we have been looking at, and I'm sure you've all heard of, the identification of autism, and we purposely are not using the word diagnosis or educational eligibility because we have come up with a new way of looking at things so that everyone hopefully looks at it the same way, both from the healthcare side and the education side. I'll explain all that briefly in a moment. We then have looked at what the evidence-based practice is in the field to date, and we've developed the Oregon Education Guidelines for Autism. We've developed a program self-assessment for districts, individual student assessments for those expanded core skills beyond the academic skills that are critical for life development. We have now today a specialization in autism, and then we have a push for transition planning and appropriate transition planning. And if you've looked at the most current information in some of our Oregon newspapers, that individuals with autism are one of the most underemployed groups of individuals in Oregon and in the country. So let me just briefly bring you up to date. We have in the identification, which deals with both from a healthcare side diagnosis and the education side eligibility, educational eligibility as having an autism spectrum disorder, we have come up with standards for the evaluation process, standards for evaluators, and that education and healthcare use those same standards so that for a parent or an individual, you don't go to one entity and they say, yes, your child has autism, and you go to the other entity and they say, oh, we have a different set of standards. No, they don't. Or the family feels like they have to go to both. And that we also then have a revised medical statement that will help get more accurate information. Those are huge issues that were one of the reasons that this commission was put in place, and we've spent two or more years getting those pieces in place. So now we have an agreement. We have an agreement with all of the vetted parties that's the direction we want to go. So our next step is, how do we take that agreement and put it in alignment with what the Oregon Department of Education and their regional program services for autism are doing in that regard? And they have some work that they're doing in terms of who will be conducting those evaluations. And so it'll be really critical that we have an opportunity to collaborate and mesh those kinds of things. It may require OER changes. It will require training. And we've talked about providing training for teams without requiring those educators or healthcare providers to go back to school, that we put training together so that they can access it and not put an additional burden on school districts. And so that funding is an issue. And then how do we distribute all of that information? So I'm going to give you a really specific example and bring you up to date. The Department of Education, they have a grant that they provide to an education entity to provide training. When I ask them, and the training is about evaluation, when I said, are you looking at what the Autism Commission has put together in that regard for the next step, I was told no.
Is the Department of Ed a part of the Autism Commission?
Yes. The Department of Ed has a representative on the commission. And in the process of putting together the recommendations and the implementation plan, we have vetted it with the department on a number of occasions, and we've heard that they are supportive of that, but we don't know how to make that next step happen for these kinds of issues. That's why we're talking about it. What can we do to make that happen, to work in a more collaborative process? Otherwise, we have a lot of recommendations that sit, and we want to have a process for doing that. So we're looking at the identification process. We know what those skills are, and we're trying to move forward on that. That's one area. Second,
before we move on, can we see if there's maybe questions on each point that you moved through? Are there other questions on this slide?
I do, actually, Madam Chair. I'm just to your last point, Marilyn. So for the next steps, is there a timeline for those? You're working with the department. The department has it established a timeline for when it will report back or work with you?
Representative Dembrow and Madam Chair, that's a really good question. The way that we understand it at this point, we have a representative from the department on our commission, and at the same time, that particular person is involved with the regional programs, and we know that they're working in 2013 to realign some of the services that regional programs are providing. So we're trying to work with them to say this would be a key time to initiate these changes. It also falls in line with the bigger picture. The diagnostic and statistical manual that drives our standards is going to be changed and go into effect in May in 2013. So 2013 is a critical year. But we don't have any specific timelines with the department to say these two need to mesh. We're trying to have some conversations about this.
Yes. No, I was just going to say maybe that's something we could ask for.
Yes, I think that's a great idea. I think two more questions following up on that. When the department said they hadn't looked at and weren't aligning with these recommendations, is what they are doing in alignment with what's happening, or is it contrary to what's happening? And the second question, are you getting the buy-in and collaboration you need from TSPC around the training component?
Yeah, this particular component doesn't have anything to do with TSPC.
Okay.
That's a little bit different. Teacher Standards and Practice Commission, and I'll talk about that in a moment.
Okay.
So that's sort of a separate component. Now I've already lost what you're...
Is what the department is doing. They've acknowledged that they haven't considered the work of the Autism Commission. Is it in alignment anyway? Is it
I don't know,
compatible, contrary to?
I don't know, because we're not sitting in on the meetings where they're moving with. I was just told by a department person we're really not using that information.
So the Autism Commission is unaware of these new initiatives around autism?
I mean, we're not invited to the table for those initiatives. We hear it from other people who are on subcommittees that are part of that regional program. I haven't seen those documents specifically.
Do you have an idea of why the Autism Commission wouldn't be invited to meetings about the development of autism services in the state of Oregon?
I'm not sure. I think that it may not be seen as a department initiative, and they have a lot of initiatives. But I think it's a very critical one because it impacts a lot of kids. And the timing is right to do that.
Thank you. And we might, as a committee, I don't know if the committee might be interested in following up with a letter to the department requesting that the Autism Commission be included in discussions about systems changes around autism. Is that something people might be interested in? Okay, thanks. Go on.
Sorry, I want to answer your questions. So another component, so we have the identification or the diagnosis component. Student is eligible for services. And then we have an incredible piece of work. We have about 20 school districts in Oregon that have been piloting what we've called our Oregon Education Guidelines and a self-assessment for the program, not so it's a comprehensive program self-assessment, and then an assessment for individual students. And it is a whole package, and it is, if you want to look at it, it's on a live binder. So we're using a lot of free things right now, which is good, but it gives people access. And we have a subcommittee that has put together this entire self-assessment for programs based on the evidence we currently have in autism. It is incredible. And if I could, I would just ask these two who represent a small district, Dallas School District, a larger district, Eugene, to just comment about that program self-assessment. Okay. Would that be?
Of course, of course. As a member of the commission.
Can you start by identifying yourself for the
sorry.
Record, please?
Thank you. I'm Susan Gartland, and I'm Special Education Director for Dallas School District. Thank you. As a member of the commission and as a member of the redesign committee, I've been personally involved with the design and structure of the and restructuring of this entire system. I've taken first a building, our middle school, through a self-assessment, and then I brought a K-12 team through a self-assessment of just where we are with autism and what our needs are. And what we found with this is that our administrators think that we're doing well. Our program staff think that we have a long ways to go. The kinds of things that we've really looked at are looking at a need for qualified staff and continuous training. The tool has been a great way to think about our direction and also just addressing the support systems around our autistic children, broadening that out with our agencies, involving family training. I think the most important part of the work is walking through the document, walking through, asking questions, and then setting a strategic plan. And that's where we are at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Gilser, my name is Marilyn Nersesi. I'm a special education administrator with the Eugene School District.
Can you move the mic over?
Say my long name again?
Yes.
Okay. To everybody, my name is Marilyn Nersesi, and I'm a special education administrator with Eugene School District. And our district has participated in piloting the assessment. And I've, in terms of the commission, before I talk to you about that, I've been working with the commission for about 3 years now, and I began on the subcommittee that was looking at an PSPC license, and then I've become part of the redesign committee, and in so doing participated in the development of this assessment. Our director of elementary education came with me up to Salem to participate with some other districts at the first unveiling of this assessment, and provided her wholehearted support for our district schools to participate in the assessment. So we've had a number of schools that have actually participated in the assessment. They are very eager to participate because of our numbers. In particular, they're looking for a very cohesive and reliable way to approach our students and to avoid a lot of time-consuming and costly missteps. And they can see that what we've put together during the participation in the pilot of the assessment, that we're moving in a very positive direction, and they're very excited about it. What happens after they do the assessment is they're able to learn a lot just by doing the assessment. It's not a high-cost thing for them in terms of what they're determining, but they come away with a clear awareness of where they want to start first to strengthen the programs in the schools. And when we did the assessment, we included general education, principals, school psychologists, a team, a range of folks participated, and they gave me their feedback, and I've brought it to the committee, so we have used their feedback to improve on the assessment. But in general, they're waiting always to hear what's next with this project.
Thank you.
So this assessment, so the Oregon guideline, there's a self-assessment. It has five component areas now. And those areas are critical to the development of a comprehensive program for individuals with autism. And districts do their own self-assessment. And they can look at any one component or all five components. So we put this together to help programs provide consistency, fidelity, cost effectiveness, and above all, quality programs for individuals with autism. Now we're at the next step stage. We continue to refine it. We pilot it with districts. Now is the time again where there's a discussion going on at the department. And the commission, we hear that because of the member on the commission, but they're realigning or talking about realignment with the regional programs. This is broader than regional programs. This is districts and early intervention and ESDs. But we need to figure out strategically, without impacting districts in a negative way, how to help them use this program assessment. We've cut it down, and we've tried to make it smaller, efficient, but allow you to assess yourself without somebody regulating you. But there needs to be some policy or other kind of action that helps us use this. And keep it current. If it's not current, then it becomes another antiquated, you know, device that we have that doesn't serve its purpose.
Thank you.
So that's where we are. And we're making progress. Then we went through the process of the ASD. We went from licensure to specialization, and I think Representative Gelzer, this was what you were talking about before. So we have this. We've completed our process initially with teacher standards and practice. Did the commission get everything they wanted in terms of specialization or licensure? No. But we got a process that is the first step. And that first step says we now have what we call in Oregon an autism spectrum disorder specialist. It will be a specialization on a special ed license. And there is a set of standards that the committees and the commission recommended that allows you to be a specialist. And it's a very specific set of standards based on evidence practice across the country, across the world. So we have that. Now, it's not a specialization that every district is required to use. There's nothing around that. So it is a TSPC option. The word optional is in there because it could be required or not required at an individual district or ESD level. There's nothing in the rule that's required that happens. The thing, and I apologize, the word can't should have an apostrophe in there. Mm-hmm. But you can't call yourself a specialist unless you meet the standards. Okay? So some really critical next steps are evolving here. We heard strongly from school psychs and speech language consultants that they wanted to be a part of that. It just didn't match up with the licensure process that we have. So we have to figure out where that is. But the next step is higher ed needs to develop their process and we've an alternate pathway, again, so that people who have those skills can demonstrate those skills without having to go back and complete a whole new course of study. Then I think the bigger piece is what can we do to make sure that those high-level, highly qualified specialists are available to every district and every regional program and every early intervention. Not that they're working with individual kids, but they're available to train and coach to fidelity those evidence-based practices that we know make a difference for kids. That's the next step we need here. Okay. And then the last piece, as critical, and as I mentioned before, there's been some even current reports in the last week about underemployment for individuals with autism spectrum disorders. So we have a whole subcommittee that's been working on transition planning. They have a plan that talks about and recommendations beginning at fifth grade or before that you start working with families to talk about what are the needs for kids with autism spectrum disorder. And one thing I failed to mention throughout everything we've done, we have identified what's called the expanded core functional skills, and those are the skills beyond academics that are critical development skills for kids with autism. They're also critical for a lot of kids with other issues, but really critical. And those would become a part of planning to make sure that those are addressed along the way. So you're not waiting till post-high school to say, oh my gosh, we forgot to think about life skills, or we forgot to think about social connections, those kinds of things. So we've worked on that. There's been collaboration and discussion with agencies, more family and student awareness. There have been the agencies talking about a maintenance of effort agreement, and we need a lot more local level implementation. 990 hours is not being fully implemented, and we want to find out ways to help people, and some of that is through this transition notebook, the expanded core skills, and how to tie those together so that kids start really early on to look toward the future and using their skills to be gainfully employed. More than gainfully employed, be an active member of their community and their life in the level that they want to be, and we know that's a critical issue. So those are the things in education that we're working on.
So Marilyn, you mentioned the 990 hours, and we passed legislation last session. It was House Bill 2283, and you may remember the long conversation we had here about students with autism, students with intellectual disability. Their unemployment rate is around 80%, and we talked about the importance of these transition services for students 18 to 21, and we passed language that said districts must make accessible a full 990-hour-a-year program and couldn't unilaterally deny students the ability to enroll full-time. You mentioned that it's not being fully implemented. I know my office has been deluged with calls and letters from people across the state who are still not able to access those hours. I heard from someone 2 weeks ago that is receiving an hour and a half every other week, and they were told that they were unhappy with that. They could transition someplace else. I requested from Portland Public Schools how it's being implemented there. Just got this information Friday, with thanks to David for getting it. Only 19% of their kids are getting 990 hours per year. That would be about 27 and a half hours per week. 68% of their students are getting less than 20 hours a week. This is an issue, and some districts are saying we didn't really intend for districts to provide full-time transition services to students. I think we were pretty clear, and since she raised it, just kind of wanted to check in with the committee to see if I had misread our discussion around that, or if our intent in saying you may not unilaterally decrease below the 990 was in fact intended to tell districts they couldn't unilaterally decrease below the 990 hours.
Madam Chair, I think we were clear to the point that some of us actually even said that we want to be very clear. Read my lips again.
Well, and I don't know if any of you are receiving that language. My office has started sharing with families that are having problems some language that they might use. We're urging them, when they go to their IEP meetings, to state in writing, my student would like to access the 990 hours that are referenced in statute. If the IEP team says no, all of the members of the IEP team, which is what families are saying is happening, urging them to document that in writing as well, to say, I requested for my student to receive this time, the school district declined this, I'm asking again, and I believe that this is a violation because it seems to be a unilateral reduction. And I'm happy to share with all of your offices that language. We're doing some trainings around the state. Different parent groups are inviting us, and you guys, I can let you know if you're interested in attending any of those or have families that are interested in some more parts of that, so we can get districts actually providing these 990 hours to students.
Representative Gelser, I think in our self-assessment then, I think we need to go back, because I think that we need to take another look at the transition area in our self-assessment, and then that may not be strong enough either, so that we make sure that they're addressing that issue. And I really do believe, if you look at the expanded core functional skills for kids starting at very early age, from the moment you're identified, mm-hmm. and you work toward that, we will improve post-high school outcomes. But we have to start early addressing all those. And that's why this commission, and scaling up and looking at the whole picture, and all of these subcommittees working together, we really believe that we've developed a comprehensive plan. We need help to bring the right people on board to implement it. because it's being implemented in bits and pieces right now. So if you have ideas or you can help in any way, we would appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there further questions from the panel? I know we're now about 25 minutes behind on our calendar.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for the wonderful presentation and for the work of the commission. I think our action item is a letter. We'll try to get that drafted and get to people before you leave the building on Wednesday. Is there anyone that won't still be here on Wednesday?
I won't be.
Will everybody be here tomorrow? Okay, so we'll get it by the end of tomorrow so we can get it signed and off to the department.
So that's very cool.
Great. Thank you very much. With that, we will close the information hearing on the 10-year strategic plan for autism. And let's take a brief recess while we all reconvene. So we're going to recess for maybe five minutes.
Yeah, okay.
So we'll come back at 3:35.
call the House Education Committee back to order, and we're going to have a presentation and discussion here for a little bit about the statewide open enrollment system that we just rolled out over the last few months for the first time. And so, panel, please go ahead.
Thank you, co-chairs Wingard and Gelser, and members of the committee. My name is Cindy Hunt, the Government Legal Affairs Manager for the Department of Education. So 3681 was enacted in 2011, and I like to look at it as it gave districts just another option for how they enrolled out-of-district students. So it was in addition to, not in place of, inter-district transfers, tuition payments, other contracts, and certainly districts have continued to use those other options, even in the light of 3681. So under 3681, districts were given very specific deadlines to meet, the first of which was March 1st of this year. By March 1st, they had to declare if they were going to opt in under 3681 and what restrictions they were going to opt in under for the coming school year. So between the 2011 session and March 1st, we received, we at the department, these gentlemen here, I would say, I'll speak for them a little bit, received a large number of questions from districts. By far, 3681 was the legislation that you passed in 2011 that had the most number of questions. We also received a large number of questions and inquiries from the press. There was a great deal of press attention, and from parents, for that matter, as well. Because of all of this, the department issued an FAQ last fall that I believe we sent to all of you and other members of the legislature and broadly distributed it. We worked with OSBA and COSA on the FAQ, both gathering questions from the field and then in the answers as well. The kinds of questions we were getting from districts as they wrestled with this was things like, what are the parameters? Do we have to provide transportation? What are the ramifications for special education students? Can we put restrictions? What does our lottery system look like? Often the answers was, you know, that's a decision of your local district. It is? Well, yes, it is. And I can tell you, too, that a lot of districts had more than one school board meeting about this and the discussions, because I got calls from some of the districts multiple times after each of these meetings as they were wrestling with it and whether or not it was the best thing and the best choice for their districts. And I know Morgan's going to go into more of the specifics from districts about kind of how many opted in and that kind of thing, but districts really wrestled with this. It wasn't a one size fits all. You know, we know that some districts said no and let in zero students for a variety of reasons, and some districts had virtually no limits as to how many students they let in, and there was any number of reasons for those decisions. So the first date, like I said, was March 1st, and then April 1st was the next deadline for when students and their parents had to apply to districts. We know from certain areas of the state that some parents applied to more than one district. And, you know, we'll be making their decisions later about which district they want to go to, depending on who they got into and that kind of thing. By May 1st, the districts had to notify the students that they actually did receive consent to come into the district. And also in May, then, the districts had to notify the home districts of those students that, in fact, they had gotten one of their students. So right now, I think it's fair to say districts are kind of wrestling with, you know, how many students and how many are actually going to come in September. So once some of these later dates, the April 1st and May 1st deadlines came, the questions that the department started getting started to shift to parents. So we got questions from parents. Some parents, you know, were disappointed that perhaps a district they wanted to get into had not opted in. That was one of the comments. Some parents were concerned that their child who was receiving special ed would be discriminated against by a district. With those parents, we were very clear with them that if, for example, they felt a district was discriminating against them, that they could file a complaint with the department. To date, we have not received any complaints regarding discrimination based on special ed or any of the other protected classes, for that matter. We are aware of one complaint that was filed against a district with the U.S. Office of Civil Rights, and I believe that complaint is still pending, and that district had already received complaints from these particular parents regarding special ed, so this just kind of was added to the existing complaints. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Morgan, although before I do that, as far as the department is concerned, our next steps is we will be doing some rulemaking around special education and 3681. What we want to do is draw very bright lines for which districts are responsible for providing special education and when. And what I mean by that is, for example, right now we have students who are in District A receiving services, but they know they're going to District B in the fall. So at what point is District B the responsible party? Where this becomes important, especially, is when we receive complaints and when we're giving guidance. So we're trying to draw very bright lines around that. So that's one area that we'll be working on over the summer. So that's in place by the time of September when these kids then actually attend school. With Morgan.
Thank you, Cindy. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Oregon School Boards Association. I think Cindy did a good job summing up the types of questions that we've received from school board members and superintendents about the bill. But what I wanted to talk a little bit about is some of the information we've gleaned, just to kind of give you some rough numbers and just feedback and policy questions that have arisen from our members over the last month or so as districts have begun to implement this. So I think you already know that because of budget reductions at the state level and the way the legislation was passed, there's no statewide data collection that the state is going to be putting together asking districts for information. So we engaged the OSBA crack research team, which consists of me and SurveyMonkey, and we sent out some questions to districts to try to just give you guys a general sense of what we're hearing for numbers, because I think there have been some newspaper reports about which districts are doing and how many, but just to try to get a better idea. So as Cindy mentioned, May 1st was the big deadline when districts started hearing how many students they would be having attending other districts, and those numbers are still coming in, and a lot of districts are still trying to gather that information. So we put together a few questions, sent them out last Tuesday, and then as of Friday, so 3 days into our little survey, we had about 100, a little over 100 districts respond, 101 districts responded, and I tried to, and I really put some caveats on this is, you know, it's not an official state data collection. It hasn't been verified. There are certainly things in the responses I got from districts that I would like to call them and sort of ask for clarification, or some of the numbers didn't look quite right to me. So I tried to be very careful and judicious in how I presented this. But of the 101 districts that have responded so far, 46 indicated they are going to enroll students under the provisions of 3681, so about 46%, a little less than half of the districts that responded.
Morgan, can I stop you before you go through those, because it is interesting, but I just want to make sure that the panel hears this answer before you. Do you have a sense of that the 101 it's over half, but was it a pretty good cross sample, or do you think that people who chose to use open enrollment were more likely to respond or less likely? Do you think it is extrapolatable, I guess, is the
Representative Wingard and members of the committee, we are going to keep the survey open until May 31st, and I'd be happy to share with the committee some updated numbers after we hear from some districts. But I can tell you that Portland, Salem Kaiser, Eugene responded, so a lot of big districts responded, as well as a lot of small districts. So I think it's pretty I didn't total up the ADM for those districts, but it's certainly a significant number, representative of the state. I mean, just to give you I'll give you a couple examples from the larger numbers in a moment. So of those districts that indicated they're doing open enrollment, I totaled up how many slots or student spaces they made available, and 34 of them indicated that they had 6,480 slots available in their district. So they put some sort of limitation, whether it was total number of students, or some of them limited to the grade level, some of them limited into schools, etc. 12 of the districts, 12 of those 46 districts indicated they had unlimited, so they would take as many students as were willing to enroll in the district, and there were a couple that didn't indicate a number. So then looking at those 46 districts that opened up, 6,500 slots, I wanted to try to get a sense, how many of those slots were actually filled? And it looks like, and again, this is where I need to go back and probably talk to some districts and stuff, but 1,943 slots, 39 districts. And one district indicated that they needed to apply the lottery provision. So just one district looks like, out of the ones that have responded, have filled the slots that they made available, and a couple didn't respond. And then the last thing I did from these questions was I just want to take a look at how many of the 101 districts responded, just to get a sense of how many of their students would be attending another district in the fall. So that's a different question than the previous three. And so 77 districts indicated that about 1,399 of their students would be enrolling in other districts under school choice or open enrollment. And just to kind of give you a couple examples at the high end from districts that responded, like Westland Wilsonville is probably going to be enrolling the most, 157 net. So they actually had students go to other districts under 3681, but netted. Eugene is another large netter, about 130. And then it looked like there were two or three districts, LaGrand, Springfield, and Portland Public, that will have a net loss of about 100 or more students. So, you know, after all the back and forth, they'll have 100 fewer students under these provisions. So, and the ranges are mostly in there. A lot of the districts, particularly a smaller district, it's a handful, four or five students in, four or five students out. So a lot of the districts netted at zero and things like that. So a couple early observations from that data. I think I would say, especially since I'm not a statistician, that if you don't have complete or verified data, it's a little bit difficult to gauge the impact of the law so far. And I think it's a little too early, whether you supported or opposed the legislation. I think it's a little bit too early to draw any conclusions, since it hasn't the first year hasn't really happened yet. Couple other observations: rural districts, the superintendents and some of the folks responding to the survey said that geography is a barrier in some of those districts. The distances are too great. They would have been interested perhaps in doing it, or, you know, there were some districts around them that did it, but they didn't lose any students under the provisions of 3681 just because geography is too much of a barrier and the winters and the mountains and things like that. One thing that was interesting is that in a lot of the responses I got from districts, it looks like a significant number of the students who are transferring under the provisions of 3681 already had inter-district transfer. So when the district opened up for open enrollment, even though they already had a transfer, they applied for those slots. So that, then I would say that's a significant number. In many districts, quite a few.
And the reason they probably did that was because this legislation allows it to become a permanent decision.
Correct.
Right?
That's correct. Again, doesn't look like a lot of districts are going to be doing any kind of lottery one for sure. And some districts obviously aren't going to need a lottery. If you set your limit at unlimited, then there's no reason to do a lottery because you'll take everyone. And then we did get some anecdotal evidence from some superintendents that they had students applying in multiple districts for slots. So that is something that's happening as well. And then just a couple observations on the back, and some of these are not new, and some of them have come up since we've sort of seen how it works. Talking to our members, some of the things we'd like to see, you know, answers to or get addressed in the coming years as this legislation and this law evolves, is one of the questions that's come up is, should there be limits? Even some of our supporters of open enrollment are concerned. For example, in online learning, only 3% of your students can leave for an online school before the district has some say in that. It looks like from the initial results I've gotten in my survey that there are going to be a few districts that are going to lose more than 3% of their students, and they mostly look like smaller districts. So that can have a significant impact. So one of the policy questions perhaps this body might want to consider is whether or not we need to look at limits such as there are with online education. Second thing is, what are the demographics of these kids? Are there socioeconomic barriers? Other indications that a lot of homeschool students are re-entering the public education system under this provision. So it'd just be interesting to sort of know what kinds of students are doing that. Another big question that I don't think we have good answers for, or that are, the answers right now are a little bit too simplistic, or why or why not districts doing this. A lot of people say, well, districts are doing it for money, or they're not doing it because they don't want to get a bunch of special ed kids. It's clear that it's much more complicated than that. Those are very simplistic answers, and some of the data I'm getting back and some of the thoughtful responses I've gotten indicate it's much more complicated than that. The other question that came up a lot, and this makes sense, is although the districts have filled their slots and enrolled students, is the question is, how many of those students are actually going to show up in the fall, and how many of them are going to stay through the school year or through their education? Are those students going to come to the new district and stay there for a year or longer? So it's just something to consider. One of the other things that has come up, you might hear from some superintendents about this, is, again, some of our members in districts who are doing this are concerned about marketing, that there's evidence that there are many districts that are using marketing practices, direct mail and other types of practices to students and families, questioning whether or not that's a proper use of public resources, even amongst our folks that like the law. And then we've already heard a little bit about special education and transportation. And I think I'll stop there and turn it over to Jeff before we have any questions to answer.
Thank Mr. Morgan. My name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I think Cindy and Morgan have really given this a great deal of coverage. As Cindy mentioned initially, we had a lot of confusion about the bill. Out there, a lot of questions that just, I don't remember how many questions were involved in the Q&A, the FAQ that was initially put out, but it was a substantial number. As time passed, the number of questions died down. I found in talking with superintendents about this, they would generally second what Morgan has to say. This is premature to try to look at any kind of data. You should call us back in September, October to take a look when we really see the student registration numbers, who follows through. The most common examples I ran into that would make you question the data are the number of students who made multiple applications and clearly intend to attend only one school. Also trying to deal with situations where students applied to a specific school. They will not be accepted into that school because it was not open, whether or not they'll want to move into the district anyway. We also, in talking with superintendents, found that generally it just as a very general statement did not appear to be a particularly disruptive situation. They did not find this to be much different than the old transfer policy. The number of students moving, not surprisingly, is pretty much in line with the number of students that were working under the old transfer policy. We're very disappointed and will continue to ask you during the session to fund a data collection that means something besides asking us to come in here with what amounts to anecdotal information. Have ODE make the collection, verify the collection, and I hope you will focus on students with no choice. There are a lot of talk about choice. The real question here is who didn't get to choose, which students are unable to move because of a variety of socioeconomic barriers that are just going to be there no matter how you set this program up. So it has, this is a program that works really well if you have someone to drive you to and from school. And at some point we need to come to grips with is that the best use of public policy and public time and money. So I look forward to talking to you about this again during the session and certainly in the future.
Representative Parrish?
So a couple questions. Morgan, probably directed to you since you're out there survey monkeying things. Two pieces of data I'm interested in is one around if you had any feedback from school superintendents who just, I mean, Washington State, it's all or nothing. You just do it. That's what the rule says. Any feedback from superintendents, because we purposefully gave them the choice of whether they wanted to participate and giving them flexibility. Maybe flexibility wasn't the answer, and we should have just gone Washington's path. So I'm curious if you've had any feedback around that. And the other thing I'm curious about is for districts that said, hey, we don't want to participate, are they still charging kids admission for the kids they do accept under old policies? I mean, are they charging them admission? Are they still out there collecting these public dollars on top of, you know, instead of having used the transfer and let the money follow the kids? So any thoughts around those two things would
sure.
be great.
Co-chairs and Representative Parrish, the second issue about tuition is, and Cindy can correct me if I'm wrong, but the one thing that I felt like when we really had a breakthrough when I went to a lot of meetings with superintendents and school board members, one of the things that really helped people understand this is an additional pathway. The other pathways, charging tuition, inter-district transfers between two districts, those pathways still all exist. So this is a new pathway, an additional pathway. And so when people heard that, that clicked. But to answer your question specifically, absolutely a district, and I don't think there are very many districts that charge tuition. There are a handful. I don't know what they've done in light of this, but there would be nothing that would prohibit a school district from enrolling students and charging tuition. And then to your larger question, you know, why, sort of the why or why not question is a big one. Certainly what I heard from a lot of board members and superintendents was that they wanted to wait a year and sort of see what happens, see how it plays out in districts around them and see what other folks are doing. There are certainly some people that I think are going to feel compelled to participate in the future out of concern that their neighbors are doing it and they don't want to be left behind. So that's, you know, there's a million reasons why districts did or did not do it. Concern about the burden of special education. I think whether or not you think that's a compelling reason for a district not to participate, I think we could all agree that, you know, one of the great failings of our education system is that particularly the federal government does not fully fund our special education students, and the burden falls on those districts. So if you're a small district and you had a high cost disability student enroll in your district, that could really put a crimp in your budget because the federal government certainly doesn't meet their obligation to educate those special ed students. And in Oregon, we have a big donut hole, and most of the districts have more special education students than we have available in our funding formula, and the high cost disabilities fund doesn't pay for those programs. So, you know, that's a separate issue, but we need to be looking at making sure that, you know, every special ed kid on an IEP, their program's fully funded. So that's one thought.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I guess this is the other piece of my comment is more directed at the concerns around socioeconomic and the ability to transfer and move. Just an anecdotal story of a woman I know who's a single mom, two kids living in the city of Portland, commuting to Hillsborough for work. Hillsborough schools wouldn't take her kids. You know, this is before this bill, wouldn't take her kids, and she had to quit her job, has not resumed working, just because of the impact of having to drive, you know, from Portland to Hillsborough, you know, and was working like a $12, $13 an hour job, and so wanted the ability to enroll her kids just from the flexibility of being able to spend more time with them. I also look at, you know, in talking to some parents where they are transitory, you know, for lack of a better word, they're losing their homes or what have you, that being able to, you know, the ability to actually keep their child in their school and make the commitment to keep that child in the school is the only form of stability that those kids actually have. So I certainly appreciate the concerns around socioeconomic and participating. I think there might actually be some of the opposite going on, too, for people who are having to, you know, work cross town and again, willing to get their kid to school to make that happen and continue to provide that kind of stability for their children. I mean, I think you might have heard me say I went to 5 elementary schools growing up. So, you know, certainly the ability to have stayed in one spot in the Portland metro area would have been a little more stabilizing in our world. So I'm not as doom and gloom around the socioeconomic perspective.
No, I think you're pointing exactly to the problem. We just don't have the kind of data. We need to know exactly how that works in all directions. How is it working? Not to confine it to just the inability to move. And I want to also just add to Morgan's comments regarding your first question. One of the problems with this, with the timing of this legislation, was it came at a time of really substantial fiscal instability on the part of the state and its ability to fund public schools. And certainly in a time, I think, if you ever find a way to adequately and stably fund public schools, I think issues like this become very different and the discussion becomes very different. But your inability to find a solution to school funding yet, we hope you'll take the time in the upcoming sessions, but that really does add, I think, to the kind of confusion that goes on around issues like this.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. The first, have we ever had a discussion, a philosophical discussion, about whether it's ever appropriate for a public school to charge tuition and what that does in terms of equity for those from that don't have the means to pay tuition to a neighboring district?
Co-Chair Gelser, Co-Chair Wickert. I was trying to think if there's ever been a bill introduced to restrict tuition. I cannot think of one off the top of my head. I mean, it's very limited which districts charge tuition in Oregon. I can only think of two off the top of my head. I know a third that was thinking about it, but I don't think they implemented it. Of the two, I don't think one let in any kids under 3681, and the other one did and continued to also charge tuition. So kind of interesting. And the third one that was considering it opened their doors wide under 3681, so I don't think they're charging tuition at all. So it's kind of interesting. But the general topic, I can't remember a time. You know, the only thing I can think of is with the full-day kindergarten and the tuition for full-day kindergarten that touched on it a bit. But that was the only time I can think of.
Well, and I would propose that it might be time for us to have that conversation as a legislative body. I'm thinking specifically of the kindergarten situation. We made a very strong statement in the assembly that we didn't believe that people should be able to charge for full-day kindergarten. The consequence of that is that my district, which had full-day kindergarten for more than 20, 25 years, doesn't have it for anybody anymore. And you know, ultimately, I agree with the position that, that public schools should not be charging tuition. So I hope we can look at that next session. The second is a point and then just another thought of something that I've learned in watching this process and hoping we can work on perhaps next session. It's true that the federal special education law has never been fully funded, but I would make the argument that in Oregon, we don't fully fund any of our students. We don't fully fund any first, second, third, fourth, or fifth grader, kindergartner, 12th grader, AP student, ELL student, any student. And I don't think that's a reason why we should ever, and I'm not suggesting that you're suggesting that, but I was surprised and disappointed in how openly school districts talked about not participating in the open enrollment process because they didn't want students with special education coming into their district. And it really concerned me the lack of reflection that people seem to have around taking a target population and saying we don't want them here. Just as it would be inappropriate to say we don't want open enrollment because we don't want students of a particular race or class or religion, the same is true for students with disabilities. And it caused me to wonder if our interdistrict transfer process, which works well in many ways, hasn't in fact been used as a way to manage the movement of students with disabilities between districts, and if students without disabilities have choices and have the ability to transfer between districts, so should students with disabilities. And when they do, they should have the same rights as other transfer students. I've been looking at the interdistrict transfer documentation that students are getting, and on the bottom of them, whether you're a student with or without a disability, it says your transfer, usually it's good until the end of the grade level of the you know, if you're going into the ninth grade till the end of high school, if you're going in first grade till the end of fifth grade. But at the bottom, it will say, unless you are a student with a disability, in which case this will be revisited each year and is dependent upon the negotiation of the contract between the districts. I don't think it's appropriate that these students have less protections than students with disabilities, and I don't think we should have a public policy that's that discriminatory. If either everybody can move in an intra-district transfer or no one can move in intra-district transfer, and I hope we can talk about whether we're comfortable with the way that it sits right now.
That's a very good question.
That's good.
Representative Frederick?
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I want to echo a couple of things that you've said already, and they're based around the fact that we need to have information about who's doing what. We do not have those details, and that frankly concerns me a great deal, because anecdotally, I'm hearing folks tell me that there are certain districts that are going to become that are already being targeted as by way of people saying, you know, we've just got too many of those folks in this particular district, in this particular school, so let's move to another place. So the demographics issue is something I'm already hearing about. It's primarily around ELL situations, not so much special ed, just so that you know, that I'm hearing ELL issues. And the other question in terms of comprehensive education for all students is the key for me. We have seen too many of the districts have had to cut programs, specific programs, and as a result, they're no longer comprehensive education. And that is forcing people to other areas as well. So I want us to be looking at that and to see what kind of data we actually have about not only who's going, but how long they're being retained that's another issue that I keep running into, is that although they, someone may move to a district that is a wealthier district, they may not be able to maintain the expected money that the parents are supposed to put up for special programs in that wealthier district, and that's an issue that we need to be watching as well.
Panel, during this process, were any of you aware of, and I, again, anecdotally, I heard this, that superintendents from school districts in certain areas gathering together in private to talk about whether or not they could agree together to not participate in open enrollment? I've actually heard about this in two entirely different areas of the state, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering whether you heard about that at all, and whether or not this is even ethical behavior on the part of superintendents.
Co-Chair Wingard, Co-Chair Gelser, early on there was that rumor out there. And when I say early on, I'm thinking like last fall. One of the areas of the state, though, that the rumor came from, specifically I'm going to say the Eugene area, based on the number of districts that opened their doors down there, it didn't happen because almost all districts in that area ended up accepting some kids under 3681. So that rumor was out there. And I'm thinking of another area, but I know there's some districts, at least in that area, that let in kids. So I'm not sure that I'm seeing ultimately the evidence that that happened, or at least not that everyone agreed.
Right.
To just
so my
say
question
no.
is not about whether or not they were ultimately able to come to an agreement, but whether or not they mm-hmm. had such a meeting and discussed such a thing.
If they did, I was not invited.
I'm not sure if I was invited or not. I think early on, there were a lot of questions about what the bill meant and how it worked, and could you opt in, opt out, all of that. And I think particularly at meetings at ESDs where, you know, people sit down and talk about legislation, and I'm talking early on before there was an FAQ, I think there was discussion of how does it work. Do we have to do it? That kind of stuff. But I don't think that any of the meetings I attended resulted in a some sort of discussion of let's none of us do it, or let's all of us do it, or any of that. It was more of a how does this work? Do I want to do it? Is there a reason I would or would not want to? Because I don't think people had thought this through. I think there was an expectation this was a much more complicated situation than it really turned out to be. Most superintendents I've talked to have agreed this made just almost no difference, ultimately, in the way students moved, except perhaps bring homeschool children into the public schools in greater numbers. And that was probably its most noteworthy accomplishment to date. Then we'll find out in September what else happened, but I don't think so. I think that would be one of those anecdotes that would be a misinterpretation of early discussions as to what is this bill and what's it mean.
I'm trying to find the article because I'm almost positive I read it. There was an Oregonian story about three school districts that had gotten together, and I'm trying to find it was in maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, Oregonian.
And I just wonder, if I may, Mr. Chair, I think the phrase secret meeting gives a different picture, but I know, you know, groups of superintendents in a meeting in a region will get together and talk about issues. I attended such a meeting. I think Mark Thielman was there that day. And the groups, what?
Where were those meetings?
But in that meeting, people talk, you know, I urged people, as I did in the Oregonian, be good neighbors, think about your neighboring districts. People talked about whether they were going to participate. I heard Mark say, I'm going to participate. I didn't see any other districts saying, be gone out of this meeting. So I did hear people having conversations about what they were going to do, how it was going to impact the region, how their inter-district transfer agreements were working or were not working, and how the decisions of other districts might impact where they were going. So I wonder if some of those, their monthly meetings, I think they're called the off the record meetings, but there's minutes kept of them.
Oh, okay.
What?
Well,
I think that I think it may have happened, but I do want to praise the vast majority of school districts for having what appears to be the bulk of their deliberations in public during their public school board meetings, as they hashed out whether or not they wanted to participate or not, which I think is the correct way to have that discussion so that the public can participate. And panel, I appreciate you being up here. And we're going to invite a couple of superintendents to share their experience with us, Mark Thielman and David Beasley.
They still have their dangling telephone line, and they all did it at the same time.
Mr. Chair, while they're setting up, these decisions were made by the school boards, right? The school board has to set. So, I mean, to that extent, there was a public process of deliberation at the school board level, no? Or there should have been?
In, as I said, in most cases, it does appear.
I mean, in every case, it had to be.
Well, they had to make a public decision, yes. But what I was praising was that from what I saw and read, a number of districts were deliberative about having a prolonged discussion. The board had a prolonged discussion on the record during their public school board meetings about how they felt about it and whether or not they wanted to participate or not. They could have easily just met and very quickly in a public meeting just made a decision.
And could I ask for a clarification on that issue? Do you take issue with superintendent, whether it's this issue or any other, meeting in their professional capacity as they do regionally to talk about how they are addressing and taking that information back to their boards who are ultimately making decisions about?
My only concern is that when, you know, if superintendents from a number of districts are meeting privately and deciding amongst themselves that they're going to encourage their school districts to not participate, that really closes off a lot of opportunities for parents because they may want to transfer, but all of the districts surrounding them are not participating because of a conversation that ultimately started with superintendents probably not thinking about those parents in that conversation. So, you know, to the extent that I have a concern, it's that I think that if superintendents have those concerns, I think it should be expressed to the school board and not necessarily, I mean, because what I heard was people actually talking about agreeing to try to not participate, and that's the kind of thing that's troubling to me. Either one of you, introduce yourself for the record, and please.
Well, I'm Dave Beasley. I'm the superintendent of the Gaston School District, and I just have a few comments. You, in the letter that I got, you asked for the positives and the negatives. I think one thing that there was a positive aspect of this law.
David, before you get to that, will you give us some sense of your process and how many spots you opened and how many you had?
Well, we opened 186 slots, and that was based on our class size and based on empty rooms in the elementary building. And
How many students are you right now? I mean,
we have about 450 or 60 students right now. We had quite a few transfers before. In our process, we acquired 31 new ones, which brought us to a total of 69 total transfer students. We think four students are transferring out. That impact on our budget is about $186,000. And nine of the 31 school district children were not from public schools. They were from either home schools or private schools, which is kind of interesting, I think. So that's kind of our experience. And in terms of spending public money, we spent about $3,800 on our campaign. We produced this document. We redid our web pages, which featured some of the things that made Gaston a little bit different. We had two open houses, and we ran some little advertisements in our local newspapers to invite people to come to open houses. Like I told my fellow superintendents, we didn't buy any radio or TV. But we got quite a few people to come and see what Gaston is all about. And as a result of that, we had quite a few people who were interested and signed up. And that's one thing that was really interesting. It allowed us to kind of focus on what really makes Gaston or any small school different. It allowed us to grow our enrollment. Gaston is kind of a landlocked community, and because we haven't had water resources, we haven't been able to add housing. And so as our kindergarten enrollment basically declines and our high school seniors is larger, we've lost kids over the last 18 years or so. We had 750 kids 15 years ago. We now have 450. So you can see we have more capacity than we have enrollment. So this is a very good alternative for us. There are some issues that I have with the way it was done. We didn't get a chance to come down and participate in the process, so I don't think any superintendent was asked for how it might work. For us, the kindergarten issue was huge because we don't know in March how many kindergarten kids have signed up for us. So that was kind of a problematic for us in that respect. The sports eligibility was problematic because it was confusing to parents. If their kids move, are they going to be eligible to do athletics? I think there were some hard feelings between districts. There are some feelings in Washington County that this promoted white flight because Gaston has very few minority students. It does create some issues for us in special education. We didn't ask any of our people coming whether they were on an IEP because we didn't think that was appropriate. But I have three autistic kids, and I sat and listened to this. Those three autistic children cost me $120,000. In my little school district, that's about the same as two teachers. So the cost for that, if I get... You know, if of these children who transfer in, if a number of them are handicapped, it will certainly negate any of the financial processes. But we still think that's worth the risk. And we also think we have pretty good programs for that in place. And so we think that overall that's positive. And the board was very insistent on participating in that. And we did have what we thought was a very reasonable budget to tell our tale. And I guess my big disappointment was that some of the districts that I saw limited the geographic region in which they would take students. And I don't, of all the things about the law that I think are problematic, I think that's it. We didn't limit, you know, you didn't have to live within 5 miles of Gaston to apply. And we have one student from Portland. We have lots of students from Hillsborough and Forest Grove and Yamhill Carlton and McMinnville. So we just felt that if there's the ability to get to our community, that we wanted you to have that opportunity to come.
Thank you, sir. And let me be clear that I'm not aware of anyone in the legislature who intended for school districts to use a geographic boundary as a limitation on students being able to attend. And I was disappointed. I shared your disappointment with the school districts that chose to do that.
Okay. Yes, sir. I guess it's my turn. I'm Mark Thielman, superintendent in Alsea School District, and we're a lot smaller than Gaston, but similar dynamics in which we were facing declining enrollment. So my first year in Alsea, and the board, when they were courting my hire, so to speak, the big issues facing districts were continual declining enrollment, able to offer fewer and fewer options, which led to more people choosing out to larger districts, neighboring districts, usually those who had more means could afford to do that because busing is not provided in those circumstances. So a higher percentage of the AKA poor and disenfranchised remaining behind, so on and so forth. And those are dynamics that get created by the old system. I mean, we just got to call what is, is. And what I told the board was, hey, there's good news. The rules are changing. And if we want to combat that, because we believe that in Alsea, due to our small size and our character of our community and the beauty of our valley and the things that we have to offer, if we believe that we can do education as well or better, then we just need to do that. So the board hired me with the full expectation that we would pursue open enrollment and a variety of other initiatives. So we started real quick with three goals. Absolutely right out of the block: student achievement, infrastructure and technology, and community relations, to deal with all the issues that are required when you fully embrace something that's very new, knowing that it's going to rub people in various ways, okay, not always in a good way. We decided to open up for 70 kids as well as 50 online kids because we worked out a contract with Insight. And everything we did with what little resources we had at the beginning of the year back in August and September was designed to support those three goals. And it was about everything that made us different. In other words, most of our neighbors had either downsized or gotten rid of their libraries, so we pushed ours out full time. Most of our neighbors went to half-day kindergarten. I think Corvallis finally gave up the ghost on that and went to half-day kindergarten. We instituted full-day kindergarten and paid for it, and it wasn't in the budget. The whole issue was we're doing this to invest in access to these new rules. Because we have geographic boundaries in ALSEI, we're half hour from everywhere, okay? We had three issues that drove the decision to explore transportation services. We were a little tepid on that, so we called it transportation services, and there's a brochure, I think you guys got a copy. And that what it really came down to in a public meeting, just AKA, was that there's three issues, reasons to bust. One is geographic. Two is economic. The poor and disenfranchised in our neighboring communities couldn't afford the gas at $4 a gallon to get their kids to ALSEI. And we're so good at what we do, we don't want anyone not to be able to come to school in ALSEI. So we have to bus. And the risks that busing takes with territories and all that. And of course, the third one is equal access. You know, the best way to combat those issues that we just discussed with white flight and all that is to run a bus. Then everybody can get on it. So the neat thing about it was once we got over the decision on that, we were able to put it in the brochure. We then listed, and you see on the back of the brochure, all the opportunities. We've actually added more since then. So we ended up funding wood shop for no money. We had a wood shop. It had been closed for years. We opened it up, assigned a teacher to it, and one period a day, and it's full. We doubled the size of our preschool, working with strengthening rural families, because preschool services in rural communities are almost non-existent. So we ended up expanding that. The district actually put some money out, and our preschool doubled in size. And it is within 3 weeks of opening up the additional 8 slots, it was full with a waiting list. So now we're looking at knocking out walls and expanding to 20-plus kids, and we're now going to go all day preschool next year. In order to fund that, we're hooking up with guys like this guy back here in the green shirt from Kings Valley Charter School, and we're doing resource share because preschool is the first place to build relationships and provide access. It's also the first place to accelerate kids, and that's the third piece. When we brought people in our open houses, we really pushed the fact that we have three things that guide what we will do with your child. One is we'll keep data, and we will communicate it to you. Two is we prevent, we accelerate, and we intervene. Okay, so we do interventions. So there's a whole slew of things that rallied our staff and our school. It's completely different. And what I didn't realize just a couple weeks ago, kind of in anticipation of kind of savoring this success, because we now have 25 students that have signed up. And after the window closed, we've averaged 2 inquiries a week. With right now, we're at 100% of those registration forms coming back. Okay, so I'm anticipating now they have to get permission and transfer into the old system. But the reason they're coming is because we're running buses. And if your neighbor is going to full-day kindergarten to compete with us, but they're charging $320 a month in tuition, we're charging nothing. That's equal access. Okay. Now, on the special ed issue, too, it was a big concern because we're a tiny district. It's absolutely detrimental if you raise, you know, if you have to generate 40, 50, 60,000. But the one thing that we don't talk about is that those kids bring funding with them. It's sometimes inadequate. It doesn't always cover the costs. But what we discovered, and as I tried to explain to my colleagues, almost all of them have brothers and sisters. And so all our high-needs disabled kids that have choiced in, we have 3 SPED kids that chosen to access open enrollment, come to our district. One is high cost, and he's an autistic child, and that mother cried tears because we were like, heck yeah, bring him in. And we had her come early and have her bring the child for an extra day and once she made up her mind to come to our district. And pretty soon she ended up enrolling his sister, who's a stellar student. And so the thing about it is I then got to hire somebody in my community who didn't have a job, and it's paid for. So I listened to the panel up here before, and I just want to be real clear, and I'll invite each and every one of you, if you want to see the impact, the positive impact, the anecdotal, qualitative data that open enrollment has done for our school and our community, come to ALSEI. Just come and we'll show you. I had a buddy come down from Washington. He called me up out of the blue. Hey, I know you're in ALSEI. I'm in Corvallis visiting friends. I said, well, hey, drive out. We'll have lunch. So he drives out to my district unplanned. I had to go up on the roof with the roof consultant after the grand storm and flood of January. We're still putting some Band-Aids on there. So I said, hey, I got to go up with this guy. It'll be about an hour. And I said, but walk around my building, introduce yourself to staff. They all know you're coming. I let them all know. So I get done with the roof consultant about an hour later, and we get in my office, and he's mad. And I was like, his name's Kim. And I said, Kim, what's wrong? And he says, well, he's like, when did you start all this stuff? I said, beginning of the year. I've only been here 7 months. He's like, well, everybody's saying the same thing. And what's open enrollment? Whoa. That's powerful. All of our staff rowing in the boat, all of them working as a team, intervening. And our student data, I'll put it up against anybody. And it's yet to be published, of course, but it will be this spring. And I strongly urge you to understand that change is hard on everybody, but there's ways to deal with the adverse effects of change. I want to thank the legislature for giving our public school the option to compete. As I've had to deal with charter schools driving their buses in and taking my funding away for years in prior districts I've been in, and it feels really good to send this out with public funds, which it's a good use, because we have resources and we have things that make education of your child special, and we want all of your kids, ELL, special ed, all of them. And we're willing to bus you in. That's how strongly we believe. So I'll get off my soapbox. I appreciate the time. But please consider those things when you're getting feedback. And come to ALSEI, please. You are all welcome.
Representative Parrish?
Thanks. So you heard the other panel address the marketing issue. Both of you guys put out nice brochures. Frankly, I mean, I think they're fantastic. And I believe in product differentiation and education, right or wrong, is a product. And trying to get, you know, my three kids who have very different needs into the same box. I've said it a lot of times. Put them all in the same box every day, expect the same result, and that's just not happening. So I'd like you guys to address the marketing piece. I know Klamath Falls, both county and city schools also did some heavy marketing. There was an Oregonian article about that as well. And just, you know, if you can address that, that'd be great.
Well, our marketing was pretty simple. We revised our web page, and I didn't know we had quite as good a technology here. We could flip it up there. But we put together a PowerPoint that people can access online that gives you a visual tour and some of the program differentiation. And we still have, just like ALSEI does, we have music, we have PE specialists in the elementary, we have technology teachers, we have these things because we think they make us different, but you have to tell people that you have that. But the other thing is that we also have class sizes that are acceptable to people. We don't have 44 kids in a high school class. I don't have classrooms that would hold 44, so that's a little bit of an issue for me. But we had to do something to make sure that people knew that. So our feeling was the open house, the PowerPoint that people could access online, because most people have access to technology, and then actually getting them in the building and having them take the tour and talk to the teachers and this sort of thing. So that was our focus, and we spent a little money, as I say, on the advertising, and it was about $3,800 because we kept track of it because we wanted to know. But, you know, our schools don't have the luxury of having public relations specialists that issue press releases and all that sort of thing. I mean, it's David and his band of merry men that have to do that. And, you know, it's not really our training, but we think we did a pretty good job.
And so, Dave, if I remember, aren't you half-time as a superintendent?
I am. Yeah. I am. Well, I'm paid half-time.
That's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
For us, very similar. We were extremely aggressive, I think, for our region because we had those meetings that about all having a regional agreement that we wouldn't, and we there was a lot of vitriol. When I sent the brochure out, it caused some interesting feedback. On the flip side, it also shook the apple tree, and a lot of our neighbors went open enrollment. And I think in the long run, everybody feels good about having those options. And I guarantee you, anecdotally, there are plans on other districts that are going to start marketing more aggressively. And the nice thing about it is you got to understand, it's a way to rally resources, because LC is not receiving any more money this year than we received before, but the results are completely different. So obviously funding isn't a direct result. Funding doesn't directly correlate to educational outcomes. And so it's about a rally cry for communities. It obviously motivated Gaston a little bit and made them feel better about the unique things that make them unique. Hey, we do have tech specialists. We have PE specialists. You know what? That does make us different. We have things to offer. Pleasant Hill is a great example. Tony, you're welcome to call him. I would encourage you. I told him I'd mention him. He ended up with 70 students, and he's just beyond. He's hiring teachers. He can't believe it. And he said, Mark, I thought it would kill small schools. And I kind of looked at him. I said, well, that's an interesting way. And I said, because that's what we were, you know, we're told it would do. Small schools have a lot to offer, and that's good for a community. So, again, that's what it's all about. So we spent $10,000 doing a very expensive mailing. We did it for shock value and all that. We had two open houses. We did a separate flyer mailing, a little newspaper. We flirted with radio, but we didn't need it because we had plenty of folks rolling in. So any other questions?
Representative Gelser?
So you mentioned the small school component. Have you had conversations, either of you, with your boards about how to pursue open enrollment and at which point that increase in enrollment changes the character of the district?
Yeah, actually, good question. Had that conversation at our last school board meeting, because we have more kindergartners from outside our district than inside signed up. And we just got confirmation that so far no one's pulling out. Had more inquiries. Had another one last Friday. Don't know if they'll come or not, but they're coming. And what does that mean? And we're having that. We have a special board meeting tonight, and we'll be having some more of that conversation. In general, it means more money, which then equates to maintain our ability to maintain programs. But it's shooken up the apple cart. So in LC, we're having a simultaneous conversation. Just had it with the county day before yesterday, where we're talking about our new discovered housing crisis in LC. Because open enrollment, we would have had more kids to report. It's one thing I should have added. We had six of our kids that signed up for open enrollment. The parents just said, oh, forget it. We're just going to do it. And they came and they bought up housing. And if that doesn't tell you, I mean, that's pretty high praise. So we didn't include them because they're moved in now. So
I have one more follow-up question. It was triggered by the idea of having more kids from out of district in kindergarten than kids that live there. My legislative district includes Corvallis and Philomath, and they butt up against each other geographically. They're very close.
Yes.
But in terms of culture, expectations, district beliefs, all of these things, it's very, very different. And I know that the Philomath School District, for several years ago, began to struggle with the challenge of people that are working in Corvallis buying housing in Philomath, or people coming up from California, and this kind of pressure within the school around the values of the student population and the beliefs of how things should be and which club is, you know, more important, the forestry club or the Zonta club. Mm-hmm. Has your community talked about what changes you might expect either in the town of Alsea or in your school district as you become more populated from people that might be from more urban or populated areas?
Well,
in terms of
conflicting
getting, expectations?
Sarah, is that they priced rent out, and so poorer people can't afford rent in Corvallis or Philomath, and some of them are locating in Alsea, and we'll take those kids too. So we have talked about trying to price new homes between $100,000 and $150,000 in that range so that working families can afford them, because it's a need. and it's fits with the values of our community, and you know, it's kind of a hardy stock timber culture, and but there's no timber. So I mean, we're having all of those things are a result of those forces are a result of that push. It's making us stronger. It's not making us weaker. And the fact that we're talking about how do we grow our community, that's a conversation, Elsie, they haven't had for a while, at least not in this way. And it's all centered around the school, which is the heart of that community. It's all they have left. And they were worried about losing their heart. What happens if we have to consolidate or be forced to consolidate? So all of those things are out there, and now we have something we do control. We have this wonderful open enrollment. We have things to offer, and people are choosing us. And you need to understand that that's a good thing for communities. It's a good thing for Gaston. It's a good thing for Eugene. It's a good thing for Pleasant Hill, and so on and so forth. And if there's communities or school districts that are losing out, then they need to get their game on. And got to remember, everything we've done, I think there's a presentation there, I just put the kindergarten results up. We did all-day kindergarten. I told the teacher, do the whole curriculum, be done by January with the entire year. Well, then what am I going to do, Mark? I said, you're going to teach them to read. I want them reading by halfway through the first grade year, the highest performing ones. And they are. Our kindergartners have spelling tests.
And I think my, thank you for that. I think my question was a little different. We can take it offline. It's more of a curiosity thing than relevant to this discussion particularly. But it's just the issue of how schools, in a lot of ways, are driven by the families that attend them. So as you're making priorities around what are the electives that are offered at the high school, what are the clubs that you can afford to have, if the school becomes bigger and you have more competitive athletics and who's on the varsity team and who's on the junior varsity team, I'm just wondering about those inter-district conflicts between families as you're prioritizing. Resources are always limited, and cultural beliefs around schools are pretty deeply held, and it's probably early on for that. I just wonder how I could share
that we had that meeting, and I think Representative Wingard was there. I asked the committee, do you want to have your own independent school district, or you know we're the smallest school district in Washington County, and although we're bigger than they are, everybody has sort of has expectations of what kind of programs you're going to have. And they said, you know, you do what you have to do, but we're going to have a school in this community. And so they've been very open to that thing. And, you know, we have interesting things. We don't cut anybody in our sports programs. So if you want to play football, you come to Gaston, we'll get your uniform, you can play football. And same thing's true of the other sports. So that may become problematic, you know, if I were, you know, crushing the rest of the state in athletics, which I've done better, but still I don't think you've read that Gaston is the powerhouse we want to be. But the community recognizes that we have to have some people come to fill those slots. We have a 300-house subdivision that's plotted and ready to go. If the economy hadn't turned, I believe Gaston would probably not have had an issue with enrollment, because that's enough houses to fill up my little school. But the housing crisis came, and we haven't built a single house up there. So
just one more thing to add, kind of on light of that. We had those same conversations, and the issue is we combated them by saying, you know, are our kids still better off if the school's still here? Is the community better off if the school's still here? So yeah, that would shake up the apple cart. And almost every, I mean, the Pioneer family, they're my board Pioneer stock. You know how that goes, because we're that tiny. We're Pioneer stock, and you know, the five names that make up the bulk of the family chain. And the thing is, there is no argument about it. Yeah, it's do this or die. And you know, the heart will keep beating, and that'll be good for our kids. They'll have to learn to compete if competition moves in and takes up the pitching spot or the quarterback spot. So those are good. One thing I do want to add, if you look on that presentation that I gave you, the actual slideshow, there is a website on there. If not, it's on the brochure as well. We also had a movie guy who lives in Alsea, makes movies, and I asked him to come in and make a promotional video. It's 20 minutes long, and it's posted online. You can get to it from our website. And I had 140 copies made, but I'm out of them, and I'm getting more manufactured. They've been quite popular, and there's, I think, several thousand views. But we show that video as well. So the district is self-marketing through electrons.
Thank you. Representative Demra.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your presentations. It really helps to see how this system is working for your districts. I want to follow on Representative Gelser's question about sort of the changing nature of the student population as more students are coming in. You know, one of the things I really value about the system of public education we have in this country is that we have local school boards who are elected by people who live in the district and whose kids, for the most part, you know, are going to the schools in the district. There's just something that feels right about that system. You know, I'm just wondering if you get to the point where, I mean, right now, say the kindergarten class is majority out of district. If that trend were to continue and now two-thirds of the kids in the school are from out of district, how does that work with the whole governance piece? There's something about it that makes me uncomfortable.
Appreciate that. I think if I understand where you're coming from in terms of, are you talking about kind of cultural nuances and how that affects, it changes the
I'm just thinking really, yeah, I'm actually thinking more about just the, you know, the governance of the district, mm-hmm. you know, by the elected school board.
Oh, you mean
school
in terms
board.
Of represented with the school
yeah,
board?
Yeah, yeah. You know, people okay. vote for their school board, and, you know, if they're having a problem with the, you know, practices in the school, you know, they can go to their neighbor who's on the school board, or they themselves can run for the school board, et cetera. You know, that's not an option for yeah. the students who are coming from out of district.
I can give you a direct answer. We address that with our community relations goal, which directly addresses that. Anybody moving in, their point of contact is they can call any board member, but is the board chair if they have a concern, just like regular patrons would have. Because that was, I mean, we've mm-hmm. believe me, we've gone through this. We talked about contingencies, and in terms of also talking about flavor, you know, address that. But again, you go back to the simple economic reality. It's that or we're not here. Now, so in ALSEI, yeah. it's a little different. I don't know about Gaston.
Well, I think the answer to that is site councils. You know, we still have our site councils, and any of our parents are eligible to participate on that and that sort of thing. So we don't think that's really a huge issue. Because there is the opportunity for input. We have lots of members of our booster club that are parents that are out, you know, outside of the district, and they're welcome and do that. So there are other avenues other than just the school board.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and just one last follow-up. Are you thinking in terms of a limit on the number of students coming in? Are your districts those that are unlimited, you know, at present?
Yeah, our limits would be by facility, and so we figure we can go to about 280. We're not there yet with the 70. We thought we'd ramp it up. So,
yeah, I've got room for about 150 more. So I don't think that's going to be a problem for us. Maybe, but...
Right.
That would be a good problem.
Good problem to have.
Representative Perry?
Well, okay, so this is a question from Mark. Can you tell me, because you and I have had a talk about above and beyond school offerings, you also have some healthcare offerings, community healthcare in your building, and how did that affect parents' decisions to come? Because you're kind of playing with a little bit different model, schools, and how do you deliver some of the, you know...
Well, that really came from the governor's talk about trying to connect schools and health clinics, you know, on the prevention end. So one day a week, our nurse practitioner basically runs her service at the school. We have an examination room we installed and put in. And it's just absolutely awesome. It's really improved our absenteeism issues for medical appointments. And then it's grown the communication between parents and nurse practitioner and the school. And when I think the best is we just had an outbreak of that really kind of virulent hand, foot, and mouth disease in ALSEI. And, man, we got on it quick. Oh, it's literally not the euphemism, but I appreciate the humor. Okay, everybody laugh. Okay, anyway. No, you're right. But it was a real problem. These poor kids were coming with broken out. And so we brought in the nurse, and she manned anybody who had any symptoms, she looked at right away, and we were sending them home. And we haven't had any other cases. All our neighbors are still having it. To me, that's powerful. And it just goes to show what can be done when schools, healthcare, and again, especially on the prevention end, that we work together.
Thanks.
Representative Comp?
I'll be very brief. I just looked up your website in Gaston, and I happened to notice something on your open enrollment site. It said your school is graffiti-free.
That's correct.
And I could make a couple of conclusions about that. I could almost take that as a racial statement, or I guess I want to know why you put that on there, and then what are your demographics?
The reason we put it on there was because we think it represents the caliber of students that come and participate in our programs. We don't have, that was a thing I noticed when I walked in the district. I said, you know, we have older buildings here and older programs, but I said that you have taken good care of them and you haven't, the children have been respectful of the process. So we wanted people to know that the kids that go to school there are participating in the process, taking care of the buildings. Our demographics were about 85% white. We're about 5% Hispanic. And then we have a plethora of a small group of some people from Croatia. And we have some children who have been adopted from Haiti, and you know, just a kind of a hodgepodge. So we are, you know, about 85% white, but and that's kind of interesting because we have larger numbers of Hispanics on both sides of us, and I think the reason that we don't have the mix is because housing has been so limited. There isn't anywhere where to come in Gaston. People that live there have lived there forever, and when their children go, they don't leave. So that's probably why our enrollment has declined.
And again, your open enrollment policy is to take, at this point, everyone who's...
Oh, right.
So
we have no problems with that.
Open.
We have an ELL program. We have an ELL teacher. We have an ELL aide. And our kids are making good progress in the work that we do with them. So that's not an issue for us at all.
Representative Frederick.
Oh, thank you. A couple of things I wanted to point out. One is that I understand what your comment is about. I should tell you that Portland schools have had for at least the last 30 years a situation where graffiti is not allowed to stay up for more than 24 hours. So that's a reality within the Portland schools. However, graffiti-free does put a couple of red flags up for me. Just want you to know that. The other thing is that we just closed a Portland school because it had fewer than 280 students in it. So that's the scale issue is a very important one. It is great to have. I've been to ALSEI and and of course Gaston many times, but been to ALSEI a number of times. Very nice little place. I enjoy it quite a bit. There is a difference, and I will be curious to see not just what happens this year, but quite frankly what happens over the next 5 years. These are very nicely done. Every Portland school put together the same kind of thing several years ago, and they've been doing it for at least the last 15 years that I know of. So it's something that is part of the larger district has also been doing it. And sometime, and when it was done the first time, it was done by the schools as well, because I was the public information director, and I was the only one in the public information office. So we didn't have anyone else to do it. The schools were doing it individually. It is an interesting approach, and the competition can be effective. But we are talking about teaching kids, and we're talking about having a comprehensive education for all kids. And it doesn't have to be the same education for all kids, but it needs to be comprehensive. So I applaud you getting that comprehensive education in your schools. Now let's make sure that it goes statewide as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you. Appreciate your comments.
Thank
you. And that other exchange led to a question I would have for the update. If we do another one in September or October, I'd be interested in how open enrollment impacts the demographics of your district. So if it's currently 85% white, does your demographic improve in terms of diversity, or does it become
The federal government mandates. In fact, it's interesting. There's rules on how you have to do that. If people don't self-report, we had to train our secretaries on how to determine or make the best guess on what the racial background is of the people registering, because the federal government wants that data. So we will have that, and the state will ask us for that, so and we'll be able to track that. So yeah, we'll have that.
Just cursory anecdotal, it's up to ours.
It's up to yours to more homogenous or more racially diverse?
More diverse, and that's a good thing.
Interesting.
Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to point out that perspective is a lot when it comes to, you know, when you made the comment on the tagging or graffiti, it had never even struck me that way, because in the Dalles in my district, it doesn't know color. I mean, it can be a non-thinking little white kid that's out there with the spray can, so I didn't even think of that. I am ashamed, Dave. I thought I'd taught you better than this, that you would have filled the other 150 seats had you used radio.
Well done.
We had to get that in.
Well done.
We worked together in that community for a lot of years, so I had that coming.
We're out of time. I appreciate you both of you. Appreciate you both sharing your stories. And
thank
Dave,
you for having us come.
It's especially gratifying for me because you'll remember that I came to those two parent meetings before the session started in 2011, and it was clear that the financial situation was dire in Gaston, and it was being communicated clearly that a merger was probably the end result. And to a person, every parent in that room said they wanted to hold on to their community school, and I am very pleased that this piece of legislation allowed them to realize that goal.
Thank you very much.
With that, we'll close the hearing.
Thank you.
And we are adjourned.